Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Paul Bremer, the top U.S. administrator in Iraq, announced today that thousands of former Ba'athists, members of Saddam Hussein's political party, will be allowed to return to their positions in the military and government. Joining us on the line from Baghdad is reporter Pamela Constable of The Washington Post. And Pam, this announcement from Bremer is a reversal of U.S. policy, which had banned Ba'athists from participating in the new Iraq. Remind us, how extensive was the ban?
It was extremely extensive. They basically banned all members of the top four tiers of the Ba'ath Socialist Party from participating in any sort of public employment or public life, as well as senior ranks of the Iraqi military. And it was very sweeping and very arbitrary, and there were procedures for appeal, but apparently those procedures were not going very well, and very few people were actually able to appeal and say, look, you know, I was a member of the party, but I was not a bad person, and I can prove it.
Yeah, we understand some were just party members in name only, but why is it being eased now, and how will different segments of the Iraqi population react to this? The Ba'athists were, in many cases, hated.
Yes, That's true. It's a somewhat controversial measure. You know, it's quite popular, you know, obviously with Sunni groups and less popular with Shiite and Kurdish groups. There are two reasons why this is happening and why now. In the first place, there's been a great deal of violence in the country over the last several months. Some of it, in particular, led by radical Sunni groups and former elements of the Ba'ath regime who've gone without jobs for over a year, and that's one of the reasons they're hell-bent on making trouble. And the second thing that's happening is that as the transition to Iraqi authority approaches on June 30th, the coalition authorities are realizing that they don't have enough qualified people to do the jobs that need to be done, especially when Americans and foreigners start withdrawing. So I think those two things coming at once have made it necessary for the coalition authorities to slightly rethink a policy that at the time, you know, was very widely supported and sort of psychologically, I think, was necessary. But maybe now, as time has passed and other issues have come to the fore.
Well, the plan now is to hand over the governing of Iraq to a caretaker government on June 30th. That's 10 weeks away. Yesterday, testimony from administration officials at a Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing seemed to indicate that the administration is now looking to give that new government only limited control over the Iraqi forces and, for instance, no ability to make new laws. How's this being received?
I don't think this is something that people here are very aware of yet. This is news that hasn't really reached Iraq and that we don't know much about ourselves. The only thing I could say to that issue is that there's a lot of concern among the coalition authorities about whether the Iraqi security forces in particular are capable of doing the job that needs to be done to keep law and order in a country that's basically been under military occupation for a year, and in which, again, you have, you know, tens of thousands of police and army people lost their jobs.
And one last item. In Fallujah, the U.S. military is threatening the insurgents that an attack will occur within days, not weeks, if the insurgents don't lay down their arms. They have been giving in some of their arms, have they not?
Yes, they have, but the problem is, according to U.S. military officials, that the quality of the weapons is not very good. They've been displaying very old and not usable weapons that they say have been turned in by the insurgents. Some military officials have called them garbage and junk, and they seem to suggest that the insurgents are trying to deceive the U.S. military forces. And what the Americans are now saying is that if they don't see some more credible evidence that the insurgents are going to take seriously the demand that they turn over weapons of high quality, that within a couple of days, the U.S. military reserves the right to resume its attacks.
Pamela Constable, thank you.
You're welcome.
Pamela reports for The Washington Post. She spoke to us from Baghdad.
Followers of Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr clashed today with Polish-led coalition troops in the Iraqi city of Karbala, killing a Bulgarian soldier. Speaking from the pulpit during Friday prayers in Najaf, al-Sadr threatened to launch suicide attacks against coalition forces if they try to attack or capture him. The tension between Sadr's militia, the Mahdi Army, and coalition forces began in early April, and clashes, particularly in southern cities in Iraq, have been frequent and fierce ever since. Christian Science Monitor reporter Dan Murphy has spent the past week in Najaf, returned to Baghdad this morning, and he joins us via sat phone. Welcome, Dan.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay. Now, in today's Christian Science Monitor, you write that al-Sadr's control of some cities in the south is on the wane, but that's not the case in Najaf. Tell us a little bit about the situation there.
Well, Najaf is a really special place at the moment. Over the past few days, I saw gunmen of his on every corner in and around Kufa, where he gave the sermon today, which I was at. There are truckloads of men with RPGs tooling around, frisking people, demanding to see papers. And the interesting thing about them is most of the supporters of Sadr in and around Najaf are not from Najaf, it appears. They've come in from nearby Baghdad and Sadr City. Nobody is there to stand up to them, and they are there in large numbers.
What particularly did he say in his Friday sermon this week that we should take note of?
Well, he always gives a real barn burner, and actually it seemed less interesting than usual until he claimed that a number of his followers had come to him and urged him to allow them to go on martyrdom operations, which is, of course, a religious code for suicide bombings. And he said, well, I told them we just have to wait, but if the Americans decide to attack us here in Najaf, then I'll probably consider using that weapon. In the past few days, the Americans have actually withdrawn further away from Najaf, an active confrontation with Sadr, because they're afraid of the real damage it could do to their image across the entire Iraqi Shiite community if they were to go into the holy city and get caught up in firefights.
So the commanders there have kind of put themselves in a situation where initially they came down very hard, and there were strong verbal threats against Sadr. We're going to have him in prison or take him dead or alive. You get the sense now that the commanders on the ground realize that when you've got that many armed men around the most important Shiite shrines, that there's no way to go into combat and come out on the winning side.
I think they've known that from day one. Unlike Fallujah, the Sunni town, where the bellicose rhetoric has started with the Marines and gone right up to the top of the CPA, the troops on the scene there have been very careful to say they recognize that it's the quote-unquote Shiite Vatican, that they could inflame Shiite sentiment, which makes up about 60% of the country, against them if anything happened in the job, and they were quite reluctant to go in. At the top of the CPA, you had incredibly bellicose rhetoric a couple of weeks ago, and those people have finally started to back away. We don't hear Sadr being called a murderer anymore, or an outlaw, or a guy that's wanted dead or alive, although that talk of a week or two ago has painted them in the back of a corner, and it remains to be seen whether they'll feel comfortable cutting a deal with him now to avoid having to remove him by force.
And, of course, in the middle of all of this are the people of Najaf. How do the ordinary citizens of the city feel about having all these armed gunmen from the Mahdi Army kind of as an unofficial police force around them?
They're afraid, and they're unhappy, and they're suffering. Najaf, although it's a very poor place, is one of the success stories of post-Saddam Iraq. Borders were opened after the invasion, and hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of pilgrims have been visiting there and bringing money, both from Iran and other parts of Iraq. This week, there's been hardly any pilgrims. They've been scared off by the violence. They don't want to go there. And also in the city, there's always been a very light U.S. or coalition military presence because of the awareness of the religious sensitivities there. So unlike a lot of places in Iraq, they didn't really feel like they were under the thumb of occupation the way many places do. So they feel that Sadr sort of brought a problem onto their doorstep.
Dan Murphy, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dan Murphy is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. He joined us on his sat phone from Baghdad. He's just returned from Najaf in southern Iraq.
Well, north of Najaf, in the city of Mosul, a roadside ambush killed one soldier and wounded several others in a convoy made up of members of the main National Guard. Tuesday's death is reportedly the first combat casualty for the 133rd Engineer Battalion since World War II. Bill Nemitz is a columnist for the Portland Press Herald. He and photographer Greg Reck are embedded with the battalion. He joins us on the line from Camp Moretz, just outside of Mosul. Welcome, Bill.
Hi, Robin.
In your report today, you quote a Major Dwayne Drummond as saying, "I really didn't think this would happen," as he visits soldiers that were injured in that convoy attack. How would you interpret that remark?
Well, it's exactly what he meant, Robin. This unit arrived here over a period from February to March. They replaced an Alabama National Guard unit that went an entire year, not only without any deaths, but without any combat-related injuries. So they were feeling like they were coming into a fairly charmed situation, and coming over, they tried to be optimistic that they would bring everyone home with them, and now here they are a month into their deployment, and it just didn't work out that way.
Yeah. What are you hearing from the reservists about the deployment? As you well know, there are a lot of Maine reservist families questioning why they have to serve so much time and why so many of them have to serve. Are there a lot there?
Right now, there are somewhere around 560 Maine soldiers attached to the 133rd here. What they're saying about their time here is that they just want to get through it. You know, it's a long, long time for them to be on the ground here. They're only 1 to 2 months into it, and right now they're all kind of just head down, leaning into this long deployment. Nobody really talks a whole lot about when it's over because that's too far away right now.
It's a year deployment?
It's a one-year deployment. That, of course, could be extended, as we've seen with some other units.
Okay.
So, you know, it's too early for them to even allow themselves to think about going home. They're settling in and just trying to make the best of a difficult situation.
How many reservists in total are there from Maine? I mean, Maine's a small state.
I think it approaches 1,000 total, mm-hmm. which for a state the size of Maine is a significant percentage of its guard.
Mm-hmm. We're hearing so much about the violence in Fallujah and in Baghdad. The battalion that you're with just, of course, saw violence and a death. But are they feeling the kind of insurgency that's being felt in other parts of the country?
It's hard to gauge because, you know, everything is so isolated. But I will tell you, we arrived here the day before Easter, and Easter Sunday, much to Greg and my surprise, there were four different mortar attacks on the camp. So we spent a good amount of our first day here in the concrete bunkers, but it's sporadic, and the consensus here is that it tends to spike, and then it abates, and then it spikes again, and I wouldn't say that they're at battle stations 24 hours a day, but there is certainly a tension all the time, and the realization that really, without any notice, things could erupt. Last week's attack on the convoy, I think, demonstrated that painfully to everybody.
Yeah.
As for the work they're doing, they are doing some work. A lot of the projects they've done to date have dealt with, for example, helping to rehabilitate an old prison, in fact, that is being used now as a training facility for the Iraq Armed Forces. They've done a lot of work down in the city, a lot of it kind of military infrastructure work so far. They built a kind of a detention center interrogation room for a base down there when they're bringing in some of the suspected insurgents. So they're working, but it's not quite yet the kind of humanitarian out there in the community work that I know they all very much want to do.
Hmm. Well, Bill, thank you.
My pleasure, Robin.
Bill Nemitz, a columnist for the Portland Press Herald, embedded with the 133rd Engineer Battalion from Maine in Mosul, Iraq.
Just ahead, the crisis in nursing homes is told by one former nursing aide.
And later, pictures the Pentagon doesn't want you to see, the flag-draped coffins of soldiers killed in Iraq.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Michael Goldfarb.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Researchers at the University of North Carolina say that a major crisis is occurring in the nation's nursing homes and will only get worse as the U.S. population ages. The new study says that employee turnover rate in nursing homes is close to 100% annually. And unless something is done about the low pay scale and frequent injuries incurred during the backbreaking work in nursing homes, the turnover in employees is not likely to change. One former nursing aide, Tom Goss, writes about these very issues, if a slightly lower turnover rate, in his new book, Nobody's Home, Candid Reflections of a Nursing Home Aide. And Tom joins us from the studios of KSMU in Springfield, Missouri. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I say candid reflections, but I don't want to characterize your overriding opinion of being a nurse's aide and being in a nursing home. What would you say, if you had to say it in a couple of sentences, what would you say your view of nursing homes is?
I would say it's a paradoxical thing. We tend to not want to look at this part of life because it's innately unattractive. But that's to our own detriment when we do that because the elderly have a great deal to offer us and we have a great deal to offer them. And the way that our society seems to be setting itself up is to separate out the people who we no longer seem useful or create difficulties for us.
Well, you have written much constructive criticism for the industry, but also, as we said, the stories that you tell of actually, you know, your feet on the ground work on the wards. Why did you decide to become a nursing home aide?
I had been living in Asia. I was teaching in Japan. My mother found out that she was diagnosed with terminal cancer, so I came back here, and I stayed with her and assisted her in her death, and that was a transforming experience. And following that, I wanted to do good work, you know.
And as an expert writes in an introduction to your book, you're entering a world that is poorly paid, physically demanding, emotionally exhausting, intellectually stultifying, at the bottom of an irrationally hierarchical power structure, and quite literally, well, I won't read the phrase, but, you know, full of...
Yeah.
full
yeah.
of...
The assaults on the senses that occur in a nursing home are the first thing that hits you. But we break down barriers. We become closer than our normal social interactions will allow. And the people there, the overriding reality in nursing homes is loneliness, you know. And so we have these yearning hearts who are reaching out just for that sense of human connection.
Yeah. Which you make. I mean, the stories of the residents who, you know, the one who's streaking her hair with toothpaste and the others mm-hmm. who, these are, you know, people in some of the worst physical and mental states, which is why they are in this relatively, you know, good nursing home. Mm-hmm. I was thinking that for people who have relatives in nursing homes, as painful as it is to read this, how heartening to know that someone like you was there. Do you think you represent most of the nurse's aides?
In everyone, I saw moments of tenderness and caring. The most heartening experience were the family members who we'd see every day in and out, spending with loved ones who often didn't even recognize them.
But the conditions themselves, what are you saying? Because as you know, so many people have a fear of nursing homes. And you write, reflect throughout the book are comments about the nursing home industry, that a nursing home with 130 beds can gross about $3 million a year. That's your boss was making $3 million. Mm-hmm. You were making $6.90 an hour, that residents mm-hmm. can spend $60,000 to $95,000 a year on care. The doctors are often just, instead of visiting patients, they visit the patient's charts because they're not paid enough by Medicaid to spend the time.
I don't have the solutions. I'm not a policymaker. Mm-hmm. But what I am saying is that to solve any problem, the first step is we have to look squarely at the reality. We have to look at things as they are. And that's the value of the book that I see, is that it just lays out, this is what's happening.
But take one example. Should the nursing home industry be only not-for-profit? That $3 million that's going to the boss, could it be better spent on the patients? Or are the patients always going to be, you know, for at least a part of the time, sleeping in their waste because mm-hmm. it's inevitable?
I think that's both true.
Mm-hmm.
There are conditions of our human nature, biological nature, which we ought to learn to accept, you know, instead of concentrating on Botox and all these things to try to pretend that we're younger than we are. And the second theme is that it appears to me that there is a built-in and inevitable conflict of interest between the extent of care and profit in the for-profit system. Our owners came in, and they were, I heard them say often, well, we can't afford this, we can't afford that, you know. If we can use the national figures, average profit margin, these people were bringing home $500,000 to $600,000 a year.
Salary.
And it's in my personal judgment, I couldn't possibly be enjoying that much money if I had a clear vision of what, you know, what difference it could have made to so many people.
Hmm.
You know, if we just had greater staffing levels, would have made a lot of difference.
You also write that long-term care industry is the most heavily regulated in America next to nuclear fusion, and that a lot of the regulations that are put in place really don't help the patients and don't help your job and are more bureaucracy than are needed, take nurses away from actually doing their work, and instead they're doing mm-hmm. paperwork. You give so many examples. What's the one thing you would want to say out loud, even if it's a small thing, that would make the life of a resident of a nursing home and a nurse's aide better?
If there was one thing I could do that wasn't done, I never saw anyone recognized for an act of kindness and caring. It's set off, off the charts, off the screen of our awareness, because we're running a business.
Mm-hmm.
But
well, that might improve the 71% turnover rate at most nursing homes.
Yeah. And I just found out recently that OSHA says that nursing home aides lead in muscular skeletal injuries than any other group in the workforce.
Well, Thomas, you say in a beautiful section of the book that you took the job in the hopes that you might somehow purchase your own goodness.
Yeah.
Did you?
It taught me that to be more open-hearted, and it taught me that if you just allow that emotion to flow, you can, at least for a moment, you can release them from the prison that they live in.
Well, Tom, thank you.
Okay.
Tom Goss, author of the new book, Nobody's Home, Candid Reflections of a Nursing Home Aide.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
It's Here and Now.
You may have noticed a picture on the front page of your newspaper this morning. It shows a flag-draped coffins of soldiers, U.S. soldiers. The image is one way of illustrating how many American men and women are paying the ultimate price in the Iraqi war. It's become the center of a storm of controversy, and it's the subject we're putting before two newspaper editors this morning. Now, joining us on the line is David Boardman. He's managing editor of the Seattle Times, which on Sunday ran a photograph of flag-draped soldier coffins taken in Kuwait by an American contractor who since lost her job because the Pentagon bans such images. Welcome, David.
Hi, Michael.
And also on the line is Guy McMillan, who's editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire, and has joined us many times in the past. Hello again, Guy.
Hi, Michael.
Okay. Now, David, how did you come across this photo, and why did you decide to run it?
We originally got the photo about almost 2 weeks ago now from a friend of the woman who had taken it. She was a former co-worker with Tammy Solicio, the woman who took the picture, had worked with her for a cargo handling company, a military subcontractor in Kosovo. And Tammy Solicio, this woman who was working for the contractor, this time in Kuwait, had emailed this photograph to her friend, just sharing this image, this moving image she had captured. And the friend felt that it's something that the American people ought to see. So she forwarded on to us. She lives in the Seattle area. She put us in touch with Tammy Solicio. We spent a week and a half talking with her, confirming that the picture was what it purported to be, researching her, researching the picture and the conditions, and importantly, making sure that she understood the potential implications of what she was doing, the fact that she might, in fact, lose her job, which, as you know, she did.
Now, you did all the research. What was your internal editorial process? Was it a difficult decision, knowing that, in effect, you were breaking a Pentagon embargo, even though it was, in fact, an amateur photograph that came to you?
Well, first of all, let me clarify that that Pentagon ban is very specifically on the taking of photographs and, of course, not on the publishing of photographs. The Pentagon can't tell us what to publish and what not to publish. So that was really not a consideration for us at that point. I have to say, from a journalistic standpoint, it was not a particularly difficult call. We thought this was such a moving picture, and its strength, if you've had the opportunity to look at it, its strength is that it evokes strong emotion in people across the political spectrum. It is not purely an anti-war photo by any means. People who are against the war will take that from it, and they see this as the human toll of the war. But people who are supportive of the war, which in fact Tammy Solicio is, see it as the respectful, honorable, caring way that these soldiers who have given their lives are handled.
Well, Guy McMillan, is this a decision that the Keene Sentinel would have made? Would you have published this photo if it had come to you in the same way?
Oh, sure. In fact, we're publishing some pictures this morning from another source, which is online pictures.
Yes, yeah, so those Pentagon pictures were produced as a result of a Freedom of Information request back in March 2003. It's taken this long to go back and forth in the Pentagon. And a gentleman in Arizona received a CD with 350 photos of flag-draped coffins. So obviously the Pentagon is taking these photos, but somehow they don't want it to get out. Anyway, he posted on a website, and now the press is free to use as many as they want, although the Pentagon says it's not going to release any more.
What's really striking about this is not pictures of war casualties. We're used to that, I think, by now in this country. It's the Pentagon's hypocritical explanation about you can't show them because of the family's sensitivity. I'm kind of noticing that we're coming up on the 60th anniversary of D-Day in a few months, and I wonder if the Pentagon's going to try to ban pictures from all those crosses in Normandy. You know, this is a nonsensical argument, but I would point out that these casualties don't belong to the Pentagon. You know, they're the nation's casualties. And like the wounded, where they attempt to keep a lid on interviews and pictures of some of the wounded soldiers, they are a reflection of what's going on over there, and we ought to know about it.
I have to add, too, that families of these fallen soldiers are by no means a monolith. And, in fact, we've been overwhelmed with response to this photograph, really, emails and calls from all over the world, but among them have been dozens and dozens from the families of soldiers, and the vast majority of those have thanked us for running the photograph.
Well, it was a pretty well-framed shot. Are you considering offering her a job as a trainee news photographer?
I don't think so. I don't think so.
And, she got the perspective just right. The coffins lining up to the open end of that C-130 and almost retreating into infinity. It was pretty good.
It's an absolutely amazing photograph. It really is. It's artistically gorgeous and yes, very very provocative in that infinity aspect.
Guy, let me just ask you, do you get the sense from your readers that as you report on the daily doings there and the upsurge in violence, that these pictures are adding to greater questioning of the mission in Iraq?
Actually, I don't. You know, I think, as somebody said earlier in this conversation, you can take these pictures and you can say this is a measure of the sacrifice that the country is prepared to pay for this cause, or you can say this is a testament to the loss of life that the country has suffered from this unwise adventure. It really doesn't amount to an editorial to show the content of the photographs that we're discussing.
And David, how about you?
Well, this, I think, actually far less than a photograph that we and others published 2 weeks ago on the day that Fallujah blew up, and with a picture of charred American bodies cast over a bridge. I think that was the day that really was, for many people, a real visual wake-up of what's happening over there.
Now, interestingly, Fox News is apparently the only major broadcast outlet that has decided not to run photos of flag-draped coffins, won't even discuss them. What do you think of that?
We noted yesterday, my colleague, the executive editor here at the paper, and I did interviews with every major broadcast outlet yesterday, and at the end of the day noted that the only one that we hadn't received a call from was Fox.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate having the opportunity.
Thank you, Michael.
David Boardman is managing editor of the Seattle Times. Guy McMillan is editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire.
Still to come, a New York actor and playwright tells of being sexually abused as a child in his acclaimed new play, The Tricky Part.
And a review of Oscar-winning director Jonathan Demme's documentary on his friend, the late Haitian journalist and freedom fighter Jean Dominique.
You're listening to Here and Now. Employers have been given the go-ahead to reduce or eliminate health benefits for retired workers when they reach age 65 and become eligible for Medicare. Companies are not required to provide any coverage to retired employees, but in the past, courts have said that if they do, they must cover all of them. They can't discriminate on the basis of age. However, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission yesterday voted along party lines, three Republicans in favor, one Democrat opposed, to make an exception to that law. Large employer associations and some unions welcome the rule change. The AARP opposed it. We're joined now by Leslie Silverman, one of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commissioners. Welcome, Commissioner Silverman.
Well, thank you for having me, Robin.
Help us understand this. What has been the previous thinking about covering an employer up to the age of 65 and after the age of 65 if they're retired?
The reality is now that for many years, employers' plans have distinguished between retirees who are pre- and post-65 and to coordinate their retiree health benefits with our Medicare system. Some employers have chosen to provide their employees with health benefits that will, quote, bridge the gap between the time they retire and become eligible for Medicare, while others continue to provide health benefits to retirees who have reached past age 65, but these benefits are supplemental to Medicare benefits.
Why isn't that age discrimination?
The question is whether or not it violates the Age Discrimination Act, this practice that has been going on for years. And one circuit court found that it did, and that was in Erie County, Pennsylvania. But the net result of that was that all the retirees got less because there was no way to comply with the law for that employer. And so as a result, the employer just stopped offering the retiree health benefits that it had. All retirees lost, both retirees under the age of 65 and retirees over the age of 65.
But our understanding of your decision, your commission's decision, is now they don't have to offer any benefits to workers who are 65 and older. And a survey of 400 large employers this year said that 20% were likely to terminate retiree coverage for future retirees in the next 3 years.
And that is exactly why we took this action, Robin. Nobody before this one court case in Pennsylvania had ever thought that this was age discrimination. The problem is that retiree health benefits with escalating costs and changes in accounting rules, fewer and fewer employers have been offering them. And that one court decision put into question the way employers had been offering them. So all we did in this decision is say that the Age Discrimination Employment Act doesn't apply to preserve the current retiree health care system. Mm.
We know, for instance, teachers' unions are in favor of your decision because so many teachers are young retirees. They feel that this will help them get better coverage. But why do you think the AARP is against it?
I think the AARP, I really think that they have this issue wrong. I mean, I really have a hard time understanding their position on this, to be truthful.
Well, from our reading of it, many of the elderly organizations feel that this just helps employers who are looking for an excuse not to cover older workers.
Employers already have an excuse not to cover older workers. And many are deciding just not to cover any retirees. And then older retirees are left only with Medicare, and younger retirees are left with nothing at all.
Commissioner Silverman, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Leslie Silverman sits on the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. She spoke to us from Washington, D.C.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
It's Here and Now.
Actor-writer Martin Moran's The Tricky Part is a one-man show which opened in New York recently to the kind of praise from the New York Times that performers dream about. The piece is a memoir of Moran's experience of sexual abuse beginning when he was 12 by a man who was 30 years old. Now, the tricky part about The Tricky Part is that in devising it, Moran, who is now 44, felt he had to meet up again with his abuser. I spoke with Martin Moran yesterday, and I asked him what it was like three decades later to confront that person.
Part of the experience was that I had created such a myth and a mountain out of him because he'd been in my psyche so deeply and hauntingly for so many years that suddenly I saw this man slumped in a bed looking initially in the first moments like someone's grandmother, very wizened and not well in a hospital in Los Angeles. And so it was shocking to see how old he was and also shocking to try and recognize in him the vigorous 30-year-old man I once knew.
And you spoke to him? Did you speak to him in anger? Did he remember you?
Yes. I mean, the first thing he said to me was, gee, I never would have recognized you. But then the moment he said that, I recognized him. And then as we spoke, he certainly remembered me. And what I felt mostly like was I made an effort to be frank. I knew there were certain things I wanted to say, and I made a point of saying them. For instance, you know, I was 12, and I was a child, and I did not have consent to give. And I want you to know how difficult this was for me all these years, that I was haunted by many things.
Now, meanwhile, you had been working on a memoir of this. You'd
Yes.
been working through the material, knowing that you would both write about it and quite possibly use it for performance because you're a professional actor. Now you've met the guy, and you're faced with, I think, what every playwright is faced with when working with autobiographical material, which is, do you use the name of the person involved?
I'll tell you, I partly resolved it because the goal, the thing that I'm so focused on in the play, is not so much the narrative of the relationship itself and the abuse itself, but rather the inquiry of the complexity of that human situation. By that I mean the fact that this was a crime and also had love involved. And I know some people will bristle at that, but it was a relationship. And so my decision was that I changed some names and I changed some details because I was more interested in rendering a piece of art and a story for a larger sense of truth.
But inevitably the man's name came out.
It did, and that was hard. And it came out just a few weeks ago in the Denver Post in a very big way, and I struggled with that mightily. I, you know, talked with my therapist a great deal. I felt a great amount of fear and trepidation. I didn't want to cause him harm. And then I thought, gee, am I still trying to protect the guy? And it was 30 years ago. Why does his name need to be in the paper? But then it began to feel that, in fact, it had grown to something larger than my play and had to do with the Denver community and had to do with the truth getting out in a clear and vital way that maybe my play was the catalyst. And I'm grateful for that. Though my play isn't about naming his name, the result of my play put his name back in the papers. And you know what? Ultimately, maybe for the first time in my life, the 12-year-old in me pointed a finger inadvertently.
Martin Moran, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
Martin Moran, actor and writer of the new play, The Tricky Part, joined us on a line from New York.
In 1993, Academy Award-winning director Jonathan Demme started filming interviews with exiled Haitian journalist and freedom fighter Jean-Dominique, the voice of Radio Haiti.
Risky business, because every information, even about the garbage in the street, was seen by the power as opposition. So when I said I tried, it was really a daily try. Every morning, you have to smell the enemy. You have to do like that.
Nous sentit que nous allons passer là, dans le très fond pays.
Jean-Dominique loved his country and its people. He became a cultural and political icon, bringing news and critical analysis to the airwaves in Creole, the language spoken by the majority of Haitians. Dominique's influence was wide and threatening. He would be forced into exile twice by the Haitian government, and then he was shot dead along with his driver 4 years ago as he arrived at the radio station to work. Jonathan Demme's new documentary, The Agronomist, is his attempt to honor Jean-Dominique. And here in our film reviewer, Renee Graham, has seen it. We would love your opinion. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Robin.
Well, it sounds powerful and timely in light of Jean-Bertrand Aristide's exile from Haiti earlier this year. Did it work? Was it an honor for this man?
It is an honor. This is a really stirring and inspiring film about this man who I think that Americans need to know more about. You know, he was a nationalist in terms of loving his country, but it was from that feeling that he wanted to make things better, and he really took on the government at a time that no one was doing that in Haiti.
And took it on in what context? I mean, what were his complaints?
He was a radio journalist, and, you know, he changed the format in radio in Haiti, which was always just entertainment-oriented, and he turned it into news and information. And he would make these remarkable commentaries about how the government was corrupt and how the people had a right to sort of rise up and protest what was going on. And that's why he was so threatening to the government.
Which government was this that he was protesting?
Originally, it was the Duvalier government of Papa Doc and then Baby Doc. Very, very brutal regime. You know, it was the kind of place where if you spoke against the government, you were going to be arrested, you were going to be jailed, and in some cases you would be killed. So it was a big deal that he had this radio station, Radio Haiti, along with his wife Michelle Montas, that had these broadcasts that became so important for the people.
We know that Jonathan Demme met Dominique when Dominique was living in New York in the 90s, and Demme was so impressed that he followed him back to Haiti when his exile was up that time. Mm-hmm. Jonathan Demme has said of Jean-Dominique that he has such magnetism and energy. He's like an actor.
He was this really, you know, charismatic man. He looked like a little elf, but he had all this power who could, you know, deal with a host of subjects. I mean, in addition to being a radio journalist before that, he co-produced and co-directed the first film made by Haitians in Haiti, and he started this country's first cinema club, which eventually was banned by the government.
Well, you mentioned he loved the land. So did Jonathan Demme. I was surprised. You know, here we know him as the director of Silence of the Lambs, Philadelphia. We know that his brother is a documentary filmmaker. But I didn't realize Jonathan Demme had made four films about Haiti.
He did, apparently. He's has this longtime love of Haitian culture. I think a lot of that pulls together with Jean-Dominique, who was so proud of his country. As you mentioned in the intro, twice Radio Haiti was taken off the air and Jean-Dominique was driven into exile. And in the clip we're about to hear, he's asked by Jonathan Demme whether or not he believes Radio Haiti will return to the airwaves in Haiti.
Do you have any doubt, Jean, that Radio Haiti will return to the air?
Any doubt? Not the shadow of the doubt. Not a shadow. I am sure. I am positive. Jonathan, you cannot kill the truth. You cannot kill justice. You cannot kill what we are fighting for. Participation of the citizen to the community business. You cannot kill that.
We should say as well that some of the music in this documentary is from Haitian hip-hop artist Wyclef Jean.
Jonathan Demme wanted him to contribute maybe a song or two, and he ended up doing the entire soundtrack.
By the way, I looked up agronomist. I had forgotten it means somebody who studies the land and the economy of the land, and that's what he did. He helped Haitian farmers improve their farming and their methods.
That was his original profession, and he makes a point in the film of saying, I didn't start as a journalist, I became a journalist. I was an agronomist. I think on some level he still sees himself that way because he is still helping the Haitian people.
Filmmaker Jonathan Demme started documenting Dominique and then put his cameras down for a while, and a horrible ending for his documentary unfolds.
He'd known Jean-Dominique for years and was making this film, but once Jean-Dominique got back to Haiti, he just simply didn't have the time that Jonathan Demme needed to help him complete this film with the interviews. So the film Demme had already shot just sat on a shelf for years and years until Dominique's assassination, and then Jonathan Demme went back to it and decided that, you know, instead of the film he wanted to make about Haiti, he could make a film that really was a tribute to his friend.
Do we know who killed Jean-Dominique?
No, we don't. Nothing was ever really done with that. I mean, there are all sorts of beliefs that obviously the government was behind it in some way, and there was a big cover-up, so no one was ever really punished for his death.
Renee, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Here now is Renee Graham, is also a pop culture correspondent for the Boston Globe. We just heard her thoughts on Jonathan Demme's new documentary on Jean Dominique, the late Haitian activist and journalist. The film is called The Agronomist.
Yo! Yo-tim to drug dealer Haiti.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Michael Goldfarb. Bill Delaney will be back Monday.
Get into your radio.
Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.